out his hand and asked if the wolf would pledge to obey the promise. The wolf's reciprocating gesture of accord has been depicted through the centuries in paintings, illustrations, murals, and statues. The animal is depicted as bowing its head in agreement, as placing its paw in the hand of St. Francis, as standing upon its hind legs and leaning against the saint's chest, as if to lick his face. The dentist introduced a small mirror into my mouth, cocking his head and pushing the tool at different angles against my cheeks. For several minutes he picked and prodded at my teeth, scraping my gum line with a long metallic tool. He glanced up at me. "Do you know you're a grinder?" he asked. I looked at him. "Sorry?" "You grind your teeth," he said. "Did you know?" "Oh," I said. "No, I didn't know." "Well," he said, "it's getting kind of ugly in there." I looked around, feeling strangely panicked. "I had no idea," I said. "It's nothing to be alarmed about," he assured me. "It's really quite common. But it does seem like something that you've started in the last few years. There's nothing in your file about it." "What do you do for work?" the dentist asked me as he grabbed my chart from the countertop. "I'm a Border Patrol agent," I told him. "Oh, wow," he said. "That must be exciting. Where are you stationed? Here in Tucson or out in the desert?" I thought briefly about how much I should tell him, unsure if he was probing or merely being friendly. "Well," I answered, "until a few weeks ago I was a field agent. I was stationed a few hours from here, out in the middle of nowhere. But I just took a detail to sector headquarters here in the city. Low-level intelligence stuff." "I see," said the dentist. "Is the work stressful?" "The grinding, you know, it comes with stress." The question surprised me. No one had ever asked me so plainly. I paused to think. "It's not stressful," I said. "No." "Hmm," the dentist said. "Seems stressful to me." I thought about my dreams. "Well," I confessed, "fieldwork could be intense sometimes, but I'll just be doing computer stuff now." The dentist silently jotted his notes in my file. "So why'd you leave the field?" he asked. "Won't you be bored?" I began to feel annoyed with his questions, concerned that I was somehow telegraphing cowardice or insecurity. "It's kind of a promotion," I said. "It's a chance to learn something new. Another side of the job, you know?" The dentist looked at me and shrugged his shoulders. "I used to have an office job," he told me. "There's only so much you can learn at a computer screen." I rolled my eyes and shook my head. "Look," I finally said, "I don't know what else to tell you. I thought it would be nice to have a break from the field, to live in the city for a while." All right," he said, holding up his hands. "I feel you. I'm just trying to make sure you don't grind your teeth out." Hayward gave us our orientation. Six of us had been detailed to the new intel center from various stations across the sector, most of us with less than 5 years in. He took us to get new identity badges, showed us how to use the keyless entry system, and gave us a tour of the office. "It's like NASA Space Command in here," he joked. The room was cavernous and without windows, filled with the sound of stale air gusting through floor vents. A multitude of double-monitor computer workstations were situated around a wall of television displays, offering an assortment of live camera feeds, real-time maps, and live 24-hour news coverage from the major cable networks. "This is where we keep track of it all," Hayward told us. "You all will be responsible for maintaining a detailed shift log around the clock and writing up daily reports for sector chiefs, summarizing the significant happenings around the sector. You'll take phone calls from the stations and keep track of emails. You'll collect and disseminate intelligence reports and safety briefs, log the opening and closing of checkpoints and roadblocks, monitor weather events like big storms and fires, and on and on. You get the drift. The main thing is for us to keep track of significant incidents at the station level. Agent-involved shootings, dead bodies, big-time dope seizures, arms confiscations, apprehensions of known gang and cartel members, things like that. You'll field calls from the station supervisors and note the time of incident, GPS coordinates, and star numbers of the agents involved. And you'll write up a brief narrative regarding each event. The rest is pretty much cake. There'll be plenty of dead time, but there's lots of sector brass moving in and out of here. So look busy, keep your boots polished, your uniform pressed, and mind your sirs and ma'ams." Outside the building, Hayward leveled with us before giving us an early dismissal. "For you boys coming straight from the field," he said, "this might seem boring as hell for a while. I know it did to me." He He explained that he preferred being in the field, but that his wife wanted them to work their way back to Northern Virginia. "I'll be honest with you," he said. "I'm trying to get the hell out of Tucson sector. There's a good opportunity for me as a supervisor. Lots of promotion potential. Might even help me and my wife get to D.C. someday, and that's why I'm here, plain and simple. But it's a good opportunity for you guys, too. A good stepping stone if you want to get your soup bars or a permanent intel position. And hell, you work 8-hour shifts, 5 days a week, and you get to live in the city. And there's air conditioning," another agent chimed in. "That's right," Hayward said. "Can't beat the air conditioning." Every day at Sector Intel, an email from the DEA came through a shared inbox. The email contained photographs and excerpted information from open-source U.S. and Mexican news media relating to the recent cartel activity in both countries. The summaries included photos of human bodies that had been disassembled, their parts scattered, separated, jumbled together, and hidden away or put on display, as if in accordance with some grim and ancient ritual. Victims' faces were frozen in death, reverberating outward from the computer screen without identity or personal history, severed from the bodies they had inhabited and the human relations that had sustained them. Each email was presented in bullet point form, offering little more than a place name, followed by a brief description of the carnage that occurred there. Acapulco, Guerrero. Two dismembered bodies found cut into 23 pieces near entrance to karaoke bar. Decapitated heads hanging from velvet ropes. Faces peeled off and draped on poles. Nuevo Laredo, Tamaulipas. Four mutilated bodies left on display in heavily trafficked downtown area. Accompanying narco message, "This happened to me for being a snitch and a pussy, but I swear I'll never do it again." Tepic, Nayarit. Two unidentified males executed and posed in front of neighborhood shop. Reportedly skinned alive before having hearts torn out. Mexico City. Beheaded male left in a truck outside elementary school with body seated at the wheel, head placed on dashboard. Zihuatanejo, Guerrero. Two corpses found discarded near freeway. Accompanying narco message, "Here's your trash. Please send more." I dream that I am clenching my jaws, unable to stop, unable to pull them apart. I clench harder and harder until an overwhelming pressure builds. Then, slowly at first, my molars begin to pop and burst. I dream that a piece of my tooth has chipped off in my mouth. As I hold the jagged shard in my hand, I feel other teeth slowly starting to flake apart. I hold my mouth closed so that I won't lose the pieces, until finally they become too many and I must spit them into my hand, where I look upon them with desperation. I dream that I am grinding my jaws from side to side, that my teeth are slowly catching and breaking as they are dragged across a decaying surface. I dream that each time I close my mouth, my top teeth become snagged against my bottom teeth. I try to carefully unlock my jaws, to slowly separate them, but the teeth pull and scrape against each other, cracking and crumbling in my mouth. I dream that my molars are falling to pieces, filling my mouth like clumps of hardened dirt. I dream that I am at the dentist's office, clenching my teeth in the lobby, pleading with the receptionist to let me in. She gives me a mouth guard, but it doesn't help. Waves of pressure surge through my gums, ripping and cracking at my teeth as if they lie upon a fault line. I dream that I am not dreaming, that I am truly clenching my teeth until they shatter in my mouth. I'm desperate to stop myself, desperate for help. This is real, I think to myself. The other dreams were different. This one is real. For his book, A Mexica, War Along the Borderline, Ed Vulliamy conducted extensive interviews with Dr. Hiram Munoz, chief forensic autopsy expert for the Tijuana Homicide Department, who has dedicated himself to deciphering the language of drug war killings. Quote, "Each different mutilation leaves a clear message. They have become a kind of folk tradition. If the tongue is cut out, it means they talk too much. A snitch, or a chupro. A man who squealed on the Klan has his finger cut off, and maybe put in his mouth. If you're castrated, you may have slept with or looked at the woman of another man in the business. Severed arms could mean that you stole from your consignment. Severed legs, that you tried to walk away from the cartel. Decapitation is another thing altogether. It is simply a statement of power, a warning to all, like public executions of old. The difference is that in normal times, the dead were disappeared or dumped in the desert. Now they are executed and displayed for all to see, so that it becomes a war against the people. My mother came to Tucson for several days to see a cardiologist recommended by a friend. When she told me, I was surprised. "What's wrong with your heart?" I asked. "It's nothing serious," she said. "Just palpitations." She offered a faint smile. "It's like my heart doesn't know what to do with itself now that I'm retired." After my mother's appointment, we made dinner together and sat in my yard watching the sun set behind lava-capped mountains. "At the doctor's office, I got to talking with this rancher in the waiting room," my mother told me as we sat down to eat. "A man with property all along the border. You wouldn't believe his stories." "Oh, yeah?" I replied. "Bet I would." She began to tell me about a local boy the rancher knew, a teenager who showed up at school one day with an expensive new car. Everyone in town thought that the boy must have been dealing drugs, but the rancher found out that every day after school, he would go to McDonald's and buy bags full of hamburgers. He'd take them to a stash house or go to some hideout spot used by border crossers and sell them for twice as much as he bought them for. He did this every day, the rancher told her, until finally he saved up enough money for a new car. The rancher explained how he used to get calls from men who said they wanted to buy land to ranch on. They would buy a property, but they wouldn't ranch it, he said. They knew nothing about ranching. They wanted the land so that they could hunt people along the border. They moved in and welcomed other men to join them, men with assault rifles and night vision goggles and bulletproof vests. He told my mother that he hated dealing with those men. He hated them, but he understood them. The man admitted it was hard to ranch along the border. He'd lost count of how many times his home had been broken into. Usually the crossers just took food and water, but sometimes they would take tools and other things they could sell. The Border Patrol's always too far away, the rancher said. They've never been able to do a thing about it. At this point, my mother said, the man became angry. It's inhumane what the government does, he told her. Border Patrol doesn't stop these people at the line. They let them cross, and they chase them on the north side, 30, 40, 50 miles or more north of the border. They let these people wreak havoc on ranchers' land. They let them die in the desert. My mother narrowed her eyes and looked at me. Is it true? She asked. I think it's a little more complicated than that, I said. I'd call it an unintended consequence. My mother tilted her head and stared at me unbelievingly. I glared back at her. What do you want me to say? I snapped. That agents are purposely driving people to their deaths? Field agents don't write border policy. We just show up and patrol where we're assigned. My mother shook her head as if my words were those of an apologist or a fanatic. I looked away from her. A line of ants made their way up the leg of my chair. Anyway, I said, I'm not a field agent anymore. My mother reached out and touched my arm. I'm glad you're not in the field. What I want, more than anything, is for you to be safe. I lifted my gaze and looked at my mother's face. And she smiled weakly. This rancher, my mother began again. He told me about these men he would see every so often on the side of the road, men asking for rides back to Mexico. He said they would feign injury or lie in the middle of the road to get him to stop. Once he stopped, the men would get in the back of his truck and refuse to move. They would pretend not to understand when he told them to get out. He said that the men scared him, that they would glare at him with hostility, that sometimes he even recognized prison tattoos on their faces and arms. My mother shook her head. Listening to him, all I could think about was you working out there in the desert, squaring off against men like that, all by yourself. She looked at me. I'm so happy you're not out there anymore, she said. I'm so happy you're safe. I looked out across the yard. Well, I said, at least you're happy. My mother tilted her head. Oh, she said, you don't like the new position? I shrugged. I don't know. Everyone says it's a good move. And sure, it's smart to go into intel after a few years in the field to work on putting together the big picture stuff. but I guess intelligence work just sounded a lot more exciting than it really is. I stared at the silhouette of the volcanic mountains in the distance. "It feels like a retreat," I finally said. The migrants who survived the journey through Mexico's interior and evade capture across the U.S. border are often shepherded by their smugglers to drop houses in the suburbs of southwestern cities and towns. In Phoenix, a police report reviewed by Wall Street Journal reporter Joel Millman in 2009 described the discovery of 22 men in the small upstairs bedroom of a rental property on a sparsely populated block of homes. "The subjects I found," wrote the local detective, "were all in their underwear and laying in a line next to each other along the walls and inside the closet. The men had been jammed in so tightly and so long that the wallboard showed indentations from bare backs pressed against it. Pink walls, decorated with the stickers of Disney characters, were stained with sweat smudges. Down a short hallway was a tiny laundry room labeled office. There, according to captives' accounts to investigators, immigrants were beaten and ordered to produce phone numbers of relatives in the U.S. who were then called and told to wire ransom money." Millman reported that in Phoenix alone, authorities discovered 194 drop houses in 2007 and 169 in 2008. In 2009, Phoenix officials reported that 68 such houses were raided in the first 5 months of the year, leading to the discovery of 1,069 undocumented migrants. "The proliferation of drop houses like these," Millman wrote, "marked, quote, a shift in the people smuggling business. A couple of decades ago, workers commonly traveled back and forth across the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, organized gangs own the people smuggling trade," end quote. This takeover, according to U.S. and Mexican police, was in part, quote, an unintended consequence of a border crackdown, end quote. As border crossings became more difficult, traffickers increased their smuggling fees. In turn, as smuggling became more profitable, it was increasingly consolidated under the regional operations of the drug cartels. Every surge in border enforcement brought a corresponding increase to the yield potential of each prospective migrant. For smuggling gangs, holding clients for ransom is a simple way of maximizing profit. Matthew Allen, the senior agent in charge of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office in Phoenix, put it succinctly to Millman, quote, "The alien becomes a commodity. One way you raise the value of that commodity is by threatening and terrorizing someone," end quote. Hayward assigned me the job of putting together a report on a drug trafficking cell active in the southwestern part of the state. For weeks, I ceaselessly entered names into databases, collected criminal histories, and analyzed smuggling techniques and crossing patterns. I was able to see each time an individual had been detained or arrested, each time they had been charged with a crime by federal, state, or local authorities. I was able to see each time an individual had entered the country on foot or by car, and if by car, the license plate number and registration information and the names and dates of birth of every other person in the vehicle. I was able to ascertain, through public records, the names of anyone, friend, family, or associates, who had ever shared an address with a given individual. I was able to access marriage licenses and death certificates. I was able to browse through alerts placed by a multitude of law enforcement agencies on any particular individual, home, or vehicle, alerts that notified me if a person was known to be violent or incompliant, if a house had been used to hide drugs or undocumented migrants, or if a vehicle had ever been seized containing arms or narcotics, or had ever been referred for secondary inspection by customs officials, border patrol agents, or drug-sniffing canines. Using a firearm serial number, I was able to query whether or not a particular weapon had ever been reported as lost or stolen, whether or not it had ever been present at the scene of a crime. I was able to call up the photographs used on each individual's driver's license or state identification card. I was able to stare at their shadowed faces and gaze into their pixelated eyes. Bodies stacked in the morgues of Mexico's border cities tell the story of an escalating drug war, Julie Watson wrote in 2009. Reporting for the Associated Press, Watson described how the Ciudad Juarez morgue had been modernized and expanded in the wake of the murders of hundreds of women in the 1990s and early 2000s, and how there were now plans to double its size in the coming year. The morgue had 7 doctors, Watson wrote, often working 12-hour days, 7 days a week. In 2 months' time, more than 460 bodies had arrived for examination. To do their work, the doctors drew blood, shaved off pieces of skin, sawed through bone, and extracted fingerprints from headless corpses. Some new hires made it only a few days before quitting. One doctor told Watson he was unable to eat after taking the job. Another said that in order to make it through the day, she had to regard the cadavers as medical evidence, not human bodies. Still, the doctors all said, they were glad to have a job in a city where gainful employment was hard to come by. The families of the dead feared identification and retribution, and so a fifth of the bodies in the morgue remained unclaimed. Some families mustered the strength to come to the morgue only to find themselves unable to take the final step of identifying the deceased, of accepting the physical manifestation of their death. They sorted through the objects that had been recovered from the bodies of their loved ones and gathered into boxes. These are their clothes, the families would acknowledge. These are their belongings. But no, they would say of the bodies, that's not them. It can't be them. In Tijuana, the director of the city morgue told Watson that his staff couldn't keep up with the pace of the killings. The magnitude overwhelmed the interment infrastructure. When Tijuana coffin makers fell behind during the December holidays, Watson wrote, the morgue there crammed 200 bodies into 2 refrigerators made to hold 80. In cities like Tijuana and Juarez, the cycle of violence was so tightly looped, so unending, that cartel members often raided morgues, reclaiming the bodies of victims, comrades, and leaders. The bodies were ferried from one death-ridden place to another, hovering indefinitely above ground, endlessly lying in wait for a place to rest in the earth. On the midnight shift, I took a call from my old station, and I immediately recognized the voice on the other end of the line. Cole, I asked. Shit, he said. Is that you, Mr. Intel? Already stuck on the graveyard shift, I see. I laughed. Well, Cole began, I'm calling to report a mass casualty incident. Goddamn, I said. That's right, he continued. While you're sitting on your sweet ass watching TV in that air-conditioned command center, wets are dropping like flies out here. Fuck you, I said. Cole snickered. Just bussing your chops. After all, someone's gotta give shit to you hotshots at Sector. Can't have you forgetting what it's like for us grunts out here in the field. Cole went on to tell me that just before dark, his training unit had come upon a half-naked man curled up in the fetal position on the desert floor. The man had been drinking his own urine for 4 days. He was barely able to talk, but Cole was able to ascertain that he had been traveling with his 2 brothers. Cole asked where they were. Behind me, the man said. Together with one of his trainees, Cole helped the man stagger out to a dirt road where he was evacuated by a helicopter to the nearest city. The man's body absorbed 6 bags of IV fluid by the time he arrived at the hospital. The doctor said he had never seen such thoroughly decimated kidneys on a man still living. Cole and his agents had spread out into the descending night to comb the desert for the man's brothers. After an hour of looking, they called for a search and rescue team from Sector headquarters. Finally, after several hours, they found the 2 bodies nearly a mile apart, one of them beneath a gnarled mesquite tree, the other lying face up and shirtless in a wash beside a hand-dug pit, his belly already swollen wide. After hanging up, I sat staring at the camera feeds on the massive screen in front of me, imagining all the bodies that I knew were out there, undiscovered under trees and in dry washes, slowly returning to the earth. Hayward walked over to me from the back of the room. What's the matter? He asked, startling me. It's nothing, I said. He hovered over me with his arms crossed, waiting for me to reveal something more. I shrugged. Sometimes I just feel like all the real work is out there. I nodded up at the camera feeds. Hayward stared at the night vision scenes of the desert. Well, he said, it's a different way of seeing things from in here, that's for sure. He looked down at me. To tell you the truth, he finally said, if you want to understand what's happening out there, It helps to know what it looks like from in here, too. He reached down and smacked me on the back. Now write me up that report. He turned to walk back to his computer. 2 hours later, Cole called again. You won't believe this, he said. My trainees just chased down a truckload of dope on our way back to the station. Your bigwig buddies are going to want to know about this one. The vehicle was loaded with 1,800 pounds. Jesus, I said, that's a ton of dope. It sure is, Cole laughed. See what you're missing? I was quiet for several seconds. Any arrests with the seizure? I asked. Well, come on now, he said. You know me better than that. All suspects fled the scene. I sighed. Look, Cole continued, I know you boys at Sector love your paperwork, but I'm still trying to get home on time. Well, I told him, that's one hell of an abandoned load. Cole chuckled. It sure is. I dream that I am back in the desert, cutting for sign along a far-off trail. I'm working in an expanse of boulders and dry, cracked-open mud flats. Looking out at the landscape, I feel free, surrounded with sparse beauty, happy to be close again to the desert. In the distance, I hear voices, and I arrive at the edge of a large rock, where I gaze out over a wash to observe a group of smugglers, gathered in a circle, speaking in hushed tones. With no time to wait for backup, I decide to jump the group alone. I bellow to announce my presence, to strike fear into their hearts. I brandish my weapon, holding it in front of my face with both arms outstretched. I yell at them in Spanish to show me their hands, to sit the fuck down, to not even think about running. The men look at me, their faces featureless and unmoving except for cold, vitreous eyes. Using pull-string handcuffs, I bind their wrists together to form a long, human chain. I line them up in front of me and order them to lead me to their hidden drug load. As we walk in silence, I begin to fear that they are leading me into a trap, that they might turn at any minute to attack. With my handheld radio, I try contacting other agents for backup. I try calling for a helicopter, but no one answers. I pass with the men through a deepening boulder field, trying to hide my panic, until finally we arrive at a high-walled box canyon, piled with trash from cartel scouts and drug mules. In a series of holes that have been bored into the walls, I observe a multitude of black wooden chests stacked atop one another. These are our belongings, the men tell me. I pull the chests from the walls and throw them open, searching for contraband and wrapped bundles, but each and every chest is empty. I look out at the walls of the canyon and find that all beauty has drained from the landscape, that I am surrounded only by the sinister threat of violence, by faceless men and stacks of empty chests. Where are the bundles? I demand of them. Their cloud-like faces blink in the darkness. You've already taken them from us. I awoke from the depths of sleep to find my phone ringing on the nightstand. Thank God, my mother said as I answered. What is it? I asked. She breathed deeply. I just got off the phone with a friend. They told me an agent had been killed in a shooting, and they heard the name Cantu on the news. My heart, I swear to God, I can hardly move. No, no, I told her. I'm safe. I'm at home. My mother stuttered and spoke over herself. I knew it couldn't be you, she said. I kept telling them, you work at a desk job now. Of course, I said. Of course. I'm fine. Thank God, my mother repeated. There's another Cantu, I told her. He works with the press. He was probably being interviewed about the shooting. He's a public information officer. Oh, she said. Of course. Of course that's it. I sat up in bed. Shit, I finally said. An agent was killed? I arrived at work to find the intel center teeming with uniformed agents and high-level command staff. Hayward came to me at the door and led me outside. Let me fill you in, he said. We walked to the parking lot and stood shielding our eyes from the sun. I'm assuming you've heard, he asked. Yes, sir, I said. Just what's in the news. Did you know him? He asked. No, sir. Hayward told me that the agent had been deployed with a small tactical unit to monitor smuggling traffic in a canyon south of Tucson. After nightfall, the agents got into a firefight with a group of bandits, and one of the men was hit. There was nothing the other agents could do for him. He was dead before EMS arrived. As Hayward spoke, I looked down and imagined, briefly, the shattered silence of the canyon, the night sky glinting above the agent as the life drained from his body. The other agents at the scene apprehended four bandits, Hayward told me. One of them is in the hospital with a gunshot wound, and the other three are in custody. A fifth bandit, probably our shooter, got away. Listen, Hayward said, there's a shit ton of field agents out there right now, crawling all over the desert. They've deployed National Guard troops, intelligence teams, and tactical units from El Paso, and auxiliary agents from stations all across the Tucson sector. They've even got drones and a goddamn Blackhawk down there. So here's the deal, Hayward continued. I need you on top of your game. Sector brass is in a frenzy. I've got higher-ups doing the high-speed wobble on every side of this. What can I do? I asked. I need you to get with the other intel agents and put together a target folder on those bandits and write up the best damn report you can. He patted me on the back and began to walk with me toward the door. I want to know everything there is to know about those arrests, he said. I want to know every time they've crossed the border, every time they've been apprehended. I want profiles on every family member and associate you can dig up. Name, address, criminal record, whatever you can find. I need to know who's a scumbag and who's just a POW. I cocked my head. A POW, sir? You know, he answered, a plain old wet. My cousin called to tell me that my great-aunt Frances had died in her sleep, 2 weeks after her 102nd birthday. I called my mother. They're having a memorial in San Diego, I told her. Can you go? Not now, she said. Not with the way my heart is. Can you? I thought for a moment. Yes, I decided. I'll drive there. Good, she said. You can go for the both of us. The night before the memorial, I drank beers with my cousins in a parking lot while we waited for an order of pizza to take back to the rest of the family. We talked about my great-aunt Frances, about my grandfather, about their brothers and sisters, about their mother and father. Frances was hardcore, one of my cousins said. She drank a shot of Canadian Club and ate a raw jalapeno every day, right until the end. She was always going on about how we were related to King Ferdinand, said another cousin, laughing. She chewed out my mom at my own baptism, I chimed in, because my mom announced to everyone that she was proud to be Mexican. Frances pulled her aside after the ceremony. We're Spanish, she scolded her. My cousins and I chuckled. 400 years in Mexico, I said, and still she clung to Europe. Frances's daughter took a long drink from her beer. You know the Pancho Villa story, right? She asked me. No, I said. Her eyes grew wide. Well, you know how our family left Mexico when Frances was a girl? Sure, I said. She raised her eyebrows at me. That was right in the middle of the Mexican Revolution. Your grandpa was just a few years old, even younger than Frances. He was born in 1910, you know, just as the war was breaking out. Anyhow, the way Frances told it, Pancho Villa's army was riding through the countryside, making war against the landholders. When the family heard that they were riding through Nuevo León to Monterrey, they hopped a freight train in the middle of the night and headed for the border. Frances said that when the sun came out that morning, they could see dead bodies hanging from the passing trees. You're shitting me, I said. Nope, that's the way Frances told it. I thought for a minute. Grandpa never mentioned it, I finally said. Francis's daughter nodded gently. He was just a little boy. The next day, I went with my family to the mausoleum where Frances had been laid to rest. Frances's daughter stood before her mother's nameplate on the wall and spoke of her love and tenacity, of her dogged dedication to family and tradition. When she was done, I went up to her. The nameplate, I said. It says Cantu instead of Abrams. That's right, she said, smiling. She requested it in her final weeks. She said she had no feeling left for her married name. It's funny, my cousin continued. Do you know you're the only one who still carries the family name? Your grandfather had 5 brothers and sisters, but somehow it turned out that you're the only one who might pass it on. I smiled. I shouldn't even have it, I said. It's only because my mother never changed her name. Well, that's right, my cousin laughed. Your mother is stubborn, just like Frances. You know, I told her, originally there was a hyphen. What do you mean? She asked. My last name, I said. Originally it was Cantu Simmons, after both my mom and my dad. When I was born, my mom still wasn't sure what she wanted to call me. They had talked about Joshua, they had talked about Tyler, so when they had to put a name down for the certificate before leaving the hospital, that's what they put. Joshua Tyler Cantu Simmons. My cousin roared with laughter. What a gringo name, she said. It wasn't until a few weeks after my mom got me home that she started calling me Paco, the Spanish nickname for her favorite saint. Soon, the other names fell away, and after my parents separated, so did the hyphen. My cousin smiled. Thank God for St. Francis, she said, saving you from that terrible name. I nodded. I'd be a different person. She put her arm around my shoulder as we began to walk toward the rest of the group. That's right, she said. A name is everything. After everyone had paid their respects to Francis, the family walked across the street to an older mausoleum that housed the remains of my grandfather and my great-grandparents. I called my mother to ask if there was anything she wanted me to say to her father. Just talk to him for me, she said. On the bottom floor, my cousins pointed to the names of our forebears on the ornate walls. Anastasio Cantú Garza y María de Calzado Cantú. Upstairs, we found my grandfather's nameplate at the end of a long hallway, three rows up from the bottom and four places away from an open window looking out over an adjacent graveyard. I was surprised by the bright sunlight streaming through the window, bathing the passageway with warmth. I had been here once before as a young boy at my grandfather's funeral, and I remembered only the faint image of a wide and dark hallway with souls stuck in the walls. As I stood by the window, Francis's daughter came up behind me. Do you see that? She said. She pointed over my shoulder. Out there, past the trees in the city, those are the hills of Tijuana. I waited as my cousins paid their respects and made their way back through the hallway and down the stairs. When I was alone, I turned to face my grandfather's name on the wall of the dead. Héctor Luis Cantú. I repeated his name in my mind as I turned to look out the window at the hills of Tijuana. Grandfather, I finally said aloud. You can see Mexico from here. In his chronicle of the Mexican Revolution, historian Frank McLinn writes of the conflict's slow waning from 1916 to 1917. Quote, after 6 years of virtually nonstop warfare, the countryside was a wasteland of bent and twisted railway tracks, gutted buildings, burned bridges, dynamited factories, carcasses of dead horses or makeshift mass graves for the human fallen. Even in the parched deserts, an endless vista of devastation could be described. In the cities and towns, indigence and destitution were widespread, and hundreds of cripples, limbless men, mutilated veterans, and gravely wounded walking hospital cases thronged the streets. End quote. The country's northern plain, he wrote, was a charnel house of human corpses. In Mexico, there is an axiom that the country is bound to suffer through 100-year cycles of uprising. The war for independence from Spain ignited in 1810, exactly 100 years before the inception of the bloody revolution against the dictatorship of Porfirio Díaz. Death toll estimates for the War of Independence range from 400,000 to 600,000. The revolution claimed anywhere from 500,000 to 2 million. Today, 100 years later, historians, journalists, and policymakers struggle to approximate a tally for the country's ongoing drug war, a conflict that began ahead of schedule when President Felipe Calderón declared war on the drug cartels in 2006, just 2 weeks after taking office in the most closely contested election in Mexican history. Calderón campaigned on a promise to clean up the streets, and more than 100,000 murders were officially tallied by the end of his 6-year tenure. In an effort to play down the skyrocketing number of drug war deaths, he argued that the vast majority of the dead were linked to the country's drug cartels. At one point, he went so far as to claim that 90% of the dead were criminals. However, academics like Molly Malloy, a research librarian and professor at New Mexico State University who studies violence in the borderlands, argue that, quote, when President Calderón or other government spokesmen say that 90% of the dead are criminals, it is also the case that fewer than 5% of the crimes have been investigated. And by reading the daily accounts of murders, one sees that the overwhelming majority of the victims are ordinary people, and that most of them are poor. Children, teenagers, old people, small business proprietors who refuse to pay extortion demands, mechanics, bus drivers, a woman selling burritos from a cart on the street. a clown juggling at an intersection, boys selling newspapers, and dozens of people who have been slaughtered inside drug rehabilitation clinics, end quote. In 2014, the Mexican government released new data officially recognizing an incidence of more than 164,000 homicides since 2007. Researchers such as Molloy are quick to remind the public that such statistics probably report a minimum number of the deaths that have occurred. They do not account for the missing and disappeared, estimated at more than 25,000 in 2012. Nor, of course, do they account for the high rates of kidnapping and extortion. These numbers also fail to take into account all those who have died or gone missing crossing the border into the United States, people often fleeing the violence-ridden towns and cities of their birth. In 2017, Manny Fernandez reported in the New York Times that the Border Patrol had recorded over 6,000 deaths in the 16 years between 2000 and 2016. In Arizona's Pima County alone, the remains of more than 2,000 migrants were found. The sheriff of another rural county in Texas told Fernandez that for everyone we find, we're probably missing five. Even as overall crossings dropped to new lows, the proportion of migrant deaths in the deadliest counties remained constant or even grew. All along the border, coroners, county medical examiners, and forensic anthropologists at state universities and nonprofit organizations struggled to identify thousands of remains. No one deserves to be just a number, one forensic expert told Fernandez. The idea is to figure out who they are and give them their name back. It is difficult, of course, to conceive of such numbers in any tangible and appropriate way. The number of border deaths, just like the number of drug war homicides, or the numbers that measure the death toll of the Mexican Revolution or the War of Independence, does little to account for all the ways that violence rips and ripples through a society, through the lives and minds of its inhabitants. On a slow shift at the Intel Center, I spent several long hours compulsively navigating dark corners of the internet, reading of kidnappings and drug massacres, decapitations and dismemberments, bodies discarded in drop houses. On a Mexican news site, I read about the discovery of 72 bodies in the state of Tamaulipas, near the town of San Fernando. 58 men and 14 women found twisted atop one another, lying blindfolded with bound hands against the wall of a cinderblock barn. The lone survivor of the massacre was an 18-year-old Ecuadorian boy who somehow managed to escape the cartel ranch after suffering a gunshot wound to the neck and feigning death underneath the bodies of his companions. In the throes of unimaginable terror, he fled for 10 miles across the arid coastal plains surrounding San Fernando. Finally, he arrived at a military checkpoint where he alerted the soldiers who would subsequently storm the ranch and discover, after the ensuing firefight, the slumped bodies that would later be identified as migrants from Brazil, Ecuador, El Salvador, and Honduras, souls forever waylaid on their passage north through the crumbling Republic of Mexico. As I read the news, I hunched above my keyboard with my head in my hands, pulling at my hair with clenched fists. I felt as if the screens were rattling before me, as if the entire room were beginning to roll away, until finally I heard my name. Cantu, Hayward yelled across the floor. Snap out of it. In an exhaustive study of news coverage in multiple borderland newspapers, Jane Zaviska, a cultural sociologist at the University of Arizona, surveyed 10 years' worth of reporting to determine the most common metaphors used by journalists writing about migrant deaths. Economic metaphors were predominant, characterizing migrant deaths as a cost, calculation, or gamble. Death is a price that is paid, a toll collected by the desert. Death is the foreseeable outcome of a cost-benefit analysis with measurable, calculable risks and consequences. Death is the ultimate risk in a game of chance, the unlucky result of a roll of the dice. Metaphors like these, Zaviska writes, naturalize death and suggest that migrants bear some responsibility for their own deaths. Violent metaphors were the second largest category, depicting death as the vengeful punishment of an angry desert or the casualty of a war waged along the border. In such discourse, deaths were blamed on unforgiving weather, on lethal immigration policy, on a lack of enforcement against an invading army of migrants. Dehumanizing metaphors constituted Zaviska's third category. Here, migrants were depicted as animals, something hunted, the persecuted prey of smugglers, law enforcement agents, and militant vigilantes. Lured to the border by the prospect of well-paying jobs, migrants engage Border Patrol trackers in a cat-and-mouse game with deadly consequences. A related metaphor, writes Zaviska, depicts enforcement agents as humane shepherds tending to a flock. This illusion, quote, reinforces the humanity of the Border Patrol, while it dehumanizes migrants by portraying the Border Patrol as saviors, end quote. An associated livestock metaphor, widespread in Mexico, casts migrants as chickens and smugglers as chicken ranchers, pollos at the mercy of their polleros. Another subcategory of metaphors describes migrants as dangerous waters threatening the nation, a metaphorical home. Enforcement is represented as an effort to staunch the unwieldy flow of migration, the border as a barrier to be plugged and sealed against a rising tide. The corresponding death toll is a surge, and the bodies are part of a flood of migrants that overwhelm Border Patrol agents and medical examiners. It is here that Zaviska cites the work of Otto Santa Anna, a sociolinguist at the University of California, Los Angeles, who argues that, ontologically, such metaphors dehumanize migrants by representing them as an undifferentiated mass. At the beginning of a swing shift, Hayward told us that he had been accepted for a command position at the Border Patrol's Tactical Operations Headquarters in El Paso. It's not Virginia, he told us, but it's two states closer. A couple years out there, he said, smiling, and I'll be sitting pretty for a position in D.C. 2 weeks later, on his last day at Sector Intel, Hayward pulled me aside. Have you ever been to El Paso? He asked me. Sure, I said. My mom used to be a ranger in a park just east of there. Well, shit, he said. You're practically a native. How'd you like to live there? I pictured the city's glittering lights, recalling how they reached across the border to form a single throbbing metropolis. I recalled, too, news of shootouts and murdered women across the river, the Juarez morgues brimming with bodies. I thought of my mother, fallen in the cracked streets, helped to her feet by a man who told us we were in our home. I'll cut to the chase, Hayward said. The intelligence team out there is looking for agents. They want guys like you, fluent in Spanish, with intel and field experience. You'd be working under me, supporting tactical operations at headquarters, which means you'd get deployed on intel missions all across the southwest border. He watched my face to gauge my reaction. Nothing's a guarantee, he cautioned. I'm not the only one doing the hiring, but I can put in a good word, and you'd have a hell of a good chance. I looked down at the carpet and felt the air gushing up from the floor vents. It's a paid move, he added, and it would get you back in the field. Early in the afternoon, sitting in boredom before the dual monitors of my workstation, I looked up to behold the massive image of a prairie falcon in one of the camera feeds at the front of the room. The bird had landed atop a distant surveillance tower somewhere in the rolling grasslands of eastern Arizona and was looking directly into the lens of the camera as if to peer into the fluorescent airlessness of our office. I stood up from my chair and walked closer to meet the bird's interrogating gaze. What cowardice has caused you to retreat from the desert? Why not return to the border's smoldering edges? Why not inhabit the quiet chaos churning in your mind? I took several steps toward the screen, as if to reach the bird. I'm afraid to come any closer, I wanted to whisper. I'm afraid the violence will no longer shake me. Hayward greeted me at the El Paso headquarters, dressed in a polo shirt and cargo pants. No uniforms, I asked him. Well, that's right, he said. Here we live the good life. I followed him through the parking lot, making note of the various buildings as he pointed them out to me. The armory, the equipment warehouse, the weight room. I followed him up a set of stairs to a modular unit with a massive air conditioner humming outside. He gestured at the adjacent building. That right there is the front office, he said, where all the head honchos are. He lowered his voice. Trust me, he whispered. You never want to end up in there. I followed Hayward through the door and walked with him toward the back of the building, past a small kitchen and a meeting room lined with topo maps, to a small office space where two plainclothes agents sat opposite each other at dual monitor workstations. "This is your new team," he smiled, nodding at the two men as they stood from their chairs. "These boys are Chuco Town natives." He pointed first at the older agent, who reached out to shake my hand. "This here is Manuel," he told me. "He's our expert in scout communications, radio intercepts, signal triangulation, geolocation, all that good stuff. Knows more than I ever will, that's for sure. You can think of him as our team dad." Manuel smiled at me. "That's right, mijo. Soy como tu papá." Hayward gestured at the other man and paused. "Beto here, well, I'm still trying to figure out what he's good at." Beto threw up his hands. "No seas malo, boss." Hayward laughed. "Just kidding," he said. "Beto's our equipment guru. He's installing big-ass signal receivers in all our rides, outfitting a travel trailer to be our mobile command center, and he claims to be pimping out our ATVs, whatever that means." Beto and Manuel smiled and stood staring at me for a few moments before looking back at Hayward. "Oh," Hayward said, "I almost forgot." He looked at them and placed a hand on my back. "Cantu here is still a little green, but he can research the shit out of just about anything. Knows how to mine any database you can think of, and can write one hell of a report." "Qué bien," Beto said, "because yo no hablo mucho English." Hayward rolled his eyes. "Very funny," he said. He looked around the room one more time. "Am I missing anything?" Manuel looked at me and sat back in his chair. "Where are you from, mijo?" he asked. "Arizona," I said. Beto's eyes lit up. "Hey, wait. Did you find a place to live yet?" "I'm still looking," I said. "You married? Got kids?" I shook my head. Beto leaned forward and snapped his fingers. "Mira," he said, "I've got this casita in my backyard I've been trying to rent out. It's like a one-room apartment, perfect for a guy like you." He grabbed a pen and tore a page from the notebook on his desk. "Here's my number, Wei. Call me and we'll talk about it." Manuel whistled. "Damn, Beto, that was fast." "All right, boys," Hayward said, motioning for me to follow him out of the office. "That's enough sweet talk for now." Hayward walked me back to my car and handed me a stack of documents. "I need these filled out by Monday for HR," he said. "Show up an hour early, and I'll take you over to the warehouse to get you outfitted with some new gear." I took the documents, glancing into the distance at the Franklin Mountains. "I'm glad to be here," I told Hayward. "Good," he replied. "Happy to have you." "But listen," he said, "I need you to hit the ground running. We deploy to Lordsburg, New Mexico, in 2 weeks for our first mission." "I'll be ready," I said. In Antígona González, Mexican poet Sara Uribe reimagines the Greek tragedy of Antigone, set in modern Mexico. In a translator's note to the English edition of the book, John Plucker writes that in Sophocles' canonical play, Antigone could not bear the dictate of Creon to leave her brother's dead body exposed and unburied on a dusty plain. In Uribe's version, Antígona González is bereft of a body to mourn, a body to bury. Plucker explains that Uribe's book, written as a kind of long-form documentary poem in response to an ongoing plague of disappearance, is actually one text made out of many, using direct quotations and language lifted from academic and philosophical texts, blog posts, newspaper crime reports, and testimonies gathered by Mexican journalists. In Uribe's poem, Antígona González searches for the body of her missing brother, and in doing so, inhabits the consciousness of all those who suffer disappearance. Quote, "Day after day, our certainties have slipped away from us." End quote. When grappling with a loss that is incomplete and unending, she continues, there are some who search as a way to refuse to remain in the silence to which they've been relegated. There are some who inquire time and time again as a means to confront their misfortune. In turn, Antígona González imagines the declarations of those who come like pilgrims to sites of massacre, to wherever they may find bodies that remain unidentified and nameless. I came to San Fernando to search for my brother. I came to San Fernando to search for my father. I came to San Fernando to search for my husband. I came to San Fernando to search for my son. I came with the others for the bodies of our people. Antígona González asks, what thing is the body when someone strips it of a name, a history, a family name? When there is no face or trail or traces or signs, what thing is the body when it's lost? We arrived in Lordsburg in the late afternoon and checked into our hotel. Hayward handed Beto and me a set of key cards and explained that we'd be sharing a room. Budget cuts, he said with a grin. Beto groaned. Hey now, Hayward said. You two are practically roommates, right? He smacked Beto on the back. You already live close enough to watch each other shower across the yard, so this won't be much different. Manuel chuckled as Beto shook his head. That's cold, boss. At sunset, we drove across the railroad tracks to a Mexican restaurant, the only business in a row of abandoned storefronts. Inside, we were met with sidelong glances as we sat down in our uniforms near the door. A long silence hung in the air as the waitress handed us our menus. After ordering, we spoke quietly to one another until an older couple stopped at our table on their way to the door. Thank you, gentlemen, for your service, the man said, nodding at Hayward. His wife smiled. You boys stay safe out there. Thank you, we said. As we ate our dinner, Manuel pointed to a small boy standing near the door of the restaurant, staring at us with his eyes wide and his mouth agape. His mother hurried over to him and bent down to speak to him in Spanish. Vámonos ya, she whispered, tugging on his arm. But the boy stood transfixed, staring at our guns and at the fabric badges sewn to our shirts. His mother looked up apologetically. He wants to be a police officer when he grows up, she explained, pushing her child away from us. The next morning, I awoke early and went to run east along the train tracks toward the rising sun. I could feel my body filling with strength as I ran, swelling with a sense of comfort beneath the wide arc of the sky. Later, riding with Manuel and Beto through the winter-blanched grasslands and playas of New Mexico's Boot Heel, I felt almost giddy to be back in the field after more than a year behind computer screens. The three of us were silent as we drove, listening to the occasional sounds of our equipment, scanning the radio waves for secret frequencies used by cartel scouts. As we neared the line, crackled voices began to filter in through our devices, and I pored over topographic maps in the back seat, looking for hilltops and other high places that might provide a vantage point for surveying the terrain and monitoring the comings and goings of marked enforcement vehicles like ours. Back in the hotel room that night, I was visited by flickering images as I slept. I dreamed of a cave littered with body parts, a landscape devoid of color and light. I saw a wolf circling in the darkness, and I felt its paws heavy on my chest, its breath hot on my face. I awoke to Beto snoring. I fumbled for my notebook in the dim light from my phone, then shut myself in the bathroom and sat on the toilet with the light on and the fan running, hurriedly scrawling every detail I could remember from the dream. Then, for several minutes, I stared into the mirror, trying to recognize myself. In the morning, I arrived late to meet Hayward and the others at the breakfast tables in the hotel lobby. No one greeted me as I sat down with a bowl of cereal and a cup of peach yogurt. Eventually, Manuel looked up from a plate of watery scrambled eggs. Listen, mijo, he said. Beto tells me you've been jacking off in the bathroom in the middle of the night. The table went silent, and then Beto and Hayward burst into laughter. I looked at Manuel. Shit, I said. I was trying to be quiet. I looked at Beto and bowed my head. I'm sorry, man, I said. I just didn't want you to know I was on the phone with your mom. Beto punched me in the shoulder as the others doubled over laughing. No me chingues, he said. My mom doesn't go for hueritos like you. Hayward leaned back in his chair. Shit, he said. You boys crack me up. He stood up from the table and adjusted his gun belt. Beto looked at him. Damn, boss, he said. Those are some shiny boots. That's right, Hayward said. I've got more meetings with the brass at Lordsburg Station today. You don't think I got to the top by dressing like you, do you? He pushed his chair in. I'll see you boys tonight. On the drive south toward the border, I rested my head against the window, trying to escape the images rattling in my mind, searching for relief in the views of broad valleys and wooded mountains. I found myself inspecting the scenery for signs and clues, for something that might explain the wrenching nature of my dream. I was aware that wolves had once roamed freely through these mountains and valleys, until they were deemed a menace and stamped out. I was aware, too, of the animal's tentative reintroduction to the landscape. Small, carefully bred packs released into closely monitored pockets of wilderness to slowly re-inhabit a terrain that had once been their own. I was jarred from my window gazing by the jangling of Beto's cell phone. I can't hear you, Ma, I heard him say. tranquila. He turned to Manuel and asked if he would pull over. After the vehicle came to a stop, he opened the passenger door and wandered into the grass at the side of the road.